Class can be taken for credit or under the Center for Lifelong Learning. For more information, contact Susan McGraw, WHFR's General Manager at 313-845-9842.
If you want to change the world, then you have to change yourself. One of the best places in the Metro Detroit area to improve your life is Henry Ford Community College. Henry Ford Community College offers dozens of degree and certificate programs, plus the opportunity to network with your peers and potential employers. Taking classes at Henry Ford Community College gives you the freedom to take your own career path and opens up an infinite number of career possibilities. Additionally, day and evening classes allow you the flexibility of building a schedule tailored to your busy lifestyle. So change the world, change yourself at Henry Ford Community College. For more information on admittance and financial aid and class schedules, call the Henry Ford Community College toll-free number at 1-800-585-HFCC. Again, that's 1-800-585-HFCC.
Hi, I'm Drew Brees, NFL quarterback for the New Orleans Saints, here with Bugs Bunny to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you fuel your body and your mind.
So what do you like to throw around the football like Drew?
Skateboard, ride a bike, or dance in your room.
Just move it your way.
And be a player.
Get up and play an hour a day, Doc. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
At letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
The healthcare industry will continue to be one of the largest employers of college graduates. More jobs are expected to be with nursing than any other occupation. Are you ready to make a difference in the world? Are you looking for an education and career that has advancement? Right now, there is a high demand for nurses, both male and female. Breaking into the nursing career means getting an education. Henry Ford Community College offers an associate's degree in the nursing program. All graduates can acquire full-time employment upon passing the licensing examination for registered nurses. For more information, please call 313-845-6300. Once again, that's 313-845-6300. Or look us up on the web at hfcc.edu. Henry Ford Community College. The right education right now.
The Global Village Party is a celebration of...
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford Community College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. Where local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.fm is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we will be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. In And our guest today is Kathleen Marden. Kathleen was trained as a social scientist and educator and holds a BA from the University of New Hampshire. For 10 years, she served as the International Director of Field Investigator Training for the Mutual UFO Network. And she's a co-author with Stanton Friedman of the book Captured, which concerns the Betty and Barney Hill abduction in 1961. The reason she's most qualified to address this historic case is the fact that she's the late Betty and Barney Hill's niece, and she studied the case from the inner family circle. Therefore, she's been able to dispel the skeptics' objections to the event with hard facts. And Kathleen is also co-author of Science Was Wrong, Startling Truths About Cures, Theories, and Inventions They Declared Impossible. Marden has appeared in many television documentaries and radio programs and lectured throughout the United States. And we are indeed honored to have her with us on the line today. Welcome to the show, Kathleen.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you today.
It's very good to have you with us. There's a lot of ground to cover, so I'd like to start with the Betty and Barney Hill experience. I assume you were close to your aunt and uncle, right?
Yes, we're very close.
Tell us about
emotionally
that.
And physically as well.
Yeah.
I lived about 20 miles away from Betty when I was growing up.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about them on a personal level.
Yes, Betty was my mother's oldest sister. She was 10 years older than my mother. She grew up on a farm in southern New Hampshire. My grandfather held every political position in the town. My grandmother was also very politically involved in supporting voters' rights for women. Mm. And so I grew up in that kind of family. Betty was a social worker. She graduated from the University of New Hampshire, and you know, that's the reason that I decided to study social work, because she loved her job so much.
Mm.
She worked as a social worker for the state of New Hampshire and was promoted to the position of supervisor before her retirement. And my uncle, Barney, grew up in Newport News, Virginia, and in Philadelphia. He worked for the post office. He had served during World War II in the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And he met Betty when he was on vacation in New Hampshire. They were both interested in the civil rights movement and both advocates of civil rights. And that's really what the common bond that they had. And my uncle moved to New Hampshire after marrying Betty. And he was very active in the community. And it increased Betty's activism as well. He was appointed by the governor of the state of New Hampshire to serve on the state advisory committee to the U.S. Civil Rights Commission.
They
were also founding members of the Rockingham County Community Action Program. They campaigned actively for Lyndon Johnson. They were Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
And the three of us were invited to Johnson's inauguration and went.
Wow.
So you can see they were active in the state of New Hampshire. They were highly respected, and they never wanted to conceal to the public that they had had a close encounter and subsequent abduction by a UFO.
You say they never wanted to reveal or conceal?
They never wanted to reveal to the public. This was supposed to remain confidential.
Right.
It was only through a violation of confidentiality that their story was made public.
Hmm. Who violated that? The doctor?
Well, somebody talked to a Boston newspaper reporter.
Hmm.
And I believe that I have an idea of who it was, but I won't mention her name since I don't have conclusive proof of that.
Mm.
But she lived in the same town as the newspaper reporter, and she was a close friend of Betty. She had heard the hypnosis tapes, or some of them. She had talked to Betty about her abduction. And I can see, as I reread the newspaper articles that ran for five full nights in October of 1965, that somebody had given this information to the reporter. Mm-hmm. It wasn't Dr. Simon, the psychiatrist that Betty and Barney saw, and it wasn't the investigator on the case. This was somebody who had heard this word of mouth, and the newspaper article was not accurate. And that's how I know that it was passed word of mouth. It was quite inaccurate, actually.
So that's where a lot of the misconceptions actually started about the case, right?
Yes.
I'm sure there are a few listeners who are unfamiliar with the case, but for the sake of those who are not, can you give us a brief overview of Betty and Barney Hill case?
Sure, I can. Betty and Barney went on a brief vacation. Betty had a week off from her job, and Barney decided to surprise her with a trip to Niagara Falls, and then they went up to Montreal. They were returning home at night through New Hampshire's White Mountains. They decided to drive into the night because a hurricane was whirling up the coast, and they wanted to arrive home before it struck. But they decided that if Barney was tired, they'd stop for the night. He was accustomed to working on the graveyard shift for the Boston Post Office anyway, and had slept well the night before.
Mm-hmm.
So they were driving through northern New Hampshire in the mountainous region when Betty spotted a new light in the sky. And it caught her attention because she thought it was a falling star, only curiously it fell upward. And she continued to watch it as it grew larger and larger in the sky. They stopped, they got out, and they looked at it as it came in closer, and they returned to the car, and they were driving through an area called Franconia Notch. It's a very beautiful scenic area of New Hampshire. And in Franconia Notch, they got out to look at this craft the second time. It was then approximately, according to Barney, about 1,000 feet away from them. Betty said that it had hovered next to the Old Man of the Mountains profile, and you might have heard of that. It was New Hampshire's state symbol that fell off the mountain in 2003, unfortunately. But the Old Man's profile was 48 feet from chin to forehead, and Betty said that the UFO was at least 1.5 times the length of the Old Man's profile. It was moving erratically. It was silent. It appeared to be rotating at that point, so they could see this blip, blip, blip as they were watching it. They returned to the car and headed south. Barney was driving. He'd stopped from time to time to look at this thing, but they didn't get out of the car again. And they were finally in an area that was populated. There were motels there and some tourist attractions. It was in the Indian Head area. And they decided to stop again. Betty was becoming excited. So Barney started to look for a place to pull over. Now, this is the off-season. I want to state that because there were not many cars on the road that night.
Okay, Kathleen, what was Betty getting excited about?
She was becoming excited because that craft was coming in closer and closer and seemed to be playing a game of cat and mouse with the car.
I see.
So Barney was looking for a place to pull over, but the craft shifted ahead and stopped just above the highway and just over the passenger side of the car, and then it descended very rapidly in their direction, causing Barney to stop the car exactly in the middle of the road, straddling the center line. He got out of the car and looked up at this craft. He had his binoculars, and Betty was looking from the passenger window. They could see a disc-shaped craft. They described it as being a giant pancake. It was about 80 feet in diameter, and it had stopped rotating at that point. They could see a row of windows, and they could see a very intense blue-white light showing from behind those windows. The craft then shifted location again to an adjacent field, and it was hovering over the field as Barney walked toward it with his binoculars. He looked up, and he could see figures staring down at him. And this was all part of his conscious recall. He stated that they were dressed in black, shiny uniforms, and that they were somehow not human. As he watched them, there was one at the window that held a special attraction for him. The others suddenly moved in unison to a wall on the back of this corridor, and Barney thought that it must have been some kind of a control panel because their arms went up. And when their arms went up into the air, the craft tilted in his direction, and he could see something drop down out of the bottom of it. There were also a red light that appeared on each side, and what seemed like little fins started to come out. And that's different from what we normally hear about UFOs, so I don't know what that was that he observed. But
so this craft was that close to where Barney could see the beings inside lift their arms and everything else, eh?
Absolutely. Hmm. He could see from the tops of their heads all the way down to their knees, he said.
Wow.
And the one at the window frightened him greatly. He thought that these beings were about to carry out a plan, and that that plan was to snatch him from that field, like he said, a bug in a net. And he grew very, very frightened. He broke away, and he ran back to the car, screaming to Betty that they had to get out of there or they were going to be captured. That is what he feared. As he entered the car, he noticed that the craft was moving in his direction. And as he sped down U.S. Highway 3, he told Betty to roll down her window and look up. She was expecting to see the lights from the craft. She didn't see any lights. All she saw was blackness. Now, it was a bright night. There was a waxing gibbous moon in the sky, and she should have seen the stars or maybe the moon or lights, but all she saw was blackness. And then suddenly, she and Barney heard a series of code-like beeping or buzzing sounds on the trunk of the car, and they caused the car to vibrate and for a tingling sensation to pass through their bodies. The next thing they knew, they found themselves 35 miles south on the same highway. They hadn't spoken to each other in all of that time, and they remembered very little about what happened in the interim. So this was very perplexing to them. They heard another series of these beeping or buzzing sounds, and it sort of jolted them back into full consciousness. They started talking to each other, and they were really looking for human contact at that point. They, as they drove south, were looking for a restaurant that might be open. Nothing was open. And they proceeded to their home in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, on the seacoast, arriving at about 5 o'clock in the morning. It was 2 hours to 3 hours later than their anticipated arrival time. And there was physical evidence that something was amiss.
So how much time do they figure they spent looking at this this craft?
They figured that they looked at the craft for approximately 15 to 20 minutes.
So that would count for maybe a half hour of their time.
Yes, it might account for some of the missing time, but certainly not all of it.
No. Okay, so then what happened?
Well, Betty was very concerned about the possibility that they might have been exposed to radiation because that craft was so close. So after they slept for a little while, she called my mother. And my mother advised her that we had a neighbor who was a physicist and she'd get in touch with him. I was in the room then, and I heard the conversation. And my mother finally reached the physicist who had been at work. This was early evening. And he told Betty that if she had a compass, she should take it out to the trunk of the vehicle to see what the needle would do. And I have no idea why he said that. Now, that certainly has nothing to do with radiation, but it has to do with magnetism.
Yeah, polarity, yeah.
Yes. So she took it, and she was moving it along the metal of the car, and then she moved it up toward the trunk. And that is when she discovered that there were some very shiny concentric circles on the trunk of the car that hadn't been there the day before. They were all the same size, and it looked as if someone had laid a template down and sprayed lacquer on the trunk of the car in that area. And so she placed the compass over those circles, and the needle would spin and spin.
Wow.
But when she moved it away, it would drop down. Barney also experimented with this, and their neighbors lived upstairs in Betty's apartment house did as well. I and my family saw those spots a couple of days later, and they were still there. Something else that happened is that Betty's dress was torn. It had been in perfectly fine shape when she'd put it on the morning of September 19th, but when she took it off on the morning of September 20th, the zipper had a 2-inch tear, and this was at the top and in the back, and there was a 1-inch tear in the thick zipper fabric itself. Her hem was torn down on one side, and the lining of the dress was torn from waist to hemline. She had no prosaic explanation for how that dress had become torn. She was only seated in the car. As far as she knew, she stopped at two restaurants. She had observed the craft. Gotten out a couple of times, but certainly nothing to explain the damage to her dress. She folded it and placed it in her closet, and the next time she took it out, it was covered with a pink powdery substance that degraded the fabric of the dress.
Did she notice that powdery substance the night she took it off for to go to bed after the trip?
No, it wasn't there when she took it off and placed it in her closet. She only noticed tears in her dress at that time. The tops of Barney's best dress shoes were scraped. They were so badly scraped that he had to wear them for yard work after that and buy a new pair of dress shoes. And their watches that had been working perfectly fine the night before, when they checked them at 10 o'clock and rewound them, had stopped working and never worked again.
Wow.
So they had all of these perplexing things that they had no prosaic explanation for.
Okay. So then they went to a psychiatrist. Why did they go to this doctor in the first place?
Initially, in Betty's first letter on September 26, 1961, to Major Donald Kehoe, who was the director of NICAP, the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, she had written that they were looking for a competent psychiatrist who might be able to hypnotize Barney because he seemed to have developed a mental block at that point and was very distressed over the experience that he had. It wasn't until a couple of years later that they actually found someone, and this was through a referral from a psychiatrist that Barney had started to see. He was seeing him because he was suffering the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder.
All because of his conscious.
Had a referral to Dr. Benjamin Simon. He was a Boston psychiatrist, a psychoanalyst, who used deep trance hypnosis He was one of the leading psychiatrists in the United States and had gained a reputation for himself during World War II when he set up the Mason General Hospital on Long Island and very successfully treated shell shock victims who were returning from the war front. Actually, the movie Let There Be Light was made about Dr. Simon's work, and he had a very long and successful career using hypnosis to resolve anxiety and amnesia and the kind of thing that Barney was suffering from. So he was a perfect doctor for them to see. And in addition to that, he didn't believe that UFOs were real.
Right.
So he was looking for a psychological reason for their experience. He hypnotized them separately. They saw him for a period of 6 months. He imposed amnesia at the end of each session so that they couldn't discuss their memories of an alien abduction with each other. He wanted to check their memories out to find out if this might have actually happened. And it was pretty amazing that they described the same kind of thing. Their memories were identical for the abduction itself. Their memories were identical for the release from this craft. And when they were on board the craft, Betty had a fuller recollection of her experiences and of her physical examination. Barney had his eyes closed most of the time and only described the sensation of what he was experiencing. As they examined both Betty's and Barney's skeletal system, they very carefully checked their hands, they removed their shoes and checked their feet, their legs, their joints. It took skin scrapings from each of them. They took hair samples. They looked into their nostrils, into their ears, and they took what appears to be a laparoscopic procedure on Betty to remove ova and also a sperm sample from Barney.
But at that time, laparoscopy did not exist as far as we knew.
As far as we knew, it was being used experimentally in a laboratory. But as far as we knew, it was not being used on humans in hospitals.
Wow.
The way it is today.
Yeah. I need to interrupt here just for a moment to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. You're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with Kathleen Martin. Kathleen is a social worker and educator, and she is the niece of Betty and Barney Hill, the famous Betty and Barney Hill abduction case from 1961. So let's get right back to Kathleen. Okay, now what were you saying, Kathleen? The scrapings and the and
yes,
the
I was talking about Betty's laparoscopic, what appears to have been a laparoscopic procedure to remove ova. And they also had taken a sperm sample from Barney. And although Barney's sperm sample was never published and never made public for many, many years, I think it was Bud Hopkins who finally brought that to the public over Betty's protests because it was such an embarrassing kind of story.
Yeah.
But despite that not being made public, abductees came forward in the 70s and in the 80s and in the 90s before it was made public and said that they had undergone the same kind of procedure.
Right.
So there were so many overlapping things. If you think of the stereotypic grays today, Betty and Barney met that type of being way back in 1961. That is what they described as the beings that abducted them.
Yeah,
they were 4.5 to 5 feet tall. They had very large cat-like eyes. Betty and Barney did not describe the huge black eyes like people see today.
Right.
But the skin was the same. The physical description was pretty much the same. They had very spindly legs and arms. Betty and Barney described what they said was like a barrel chest or torso.
Hmm.
Larger heads in proportion to their bodies than humans. The same thing, telepathic communication. Everything that alien abductees describe today.
Right. And I've mentioned on the show before that this was going on really all over the world, this same type of scenario. But it never came out because psychiatrists would talk to these people and determine within conventional wisdom that they were delusional, they were schizophrenic, they were having sleep paralysis, you name it, you know, whatever was within conventional wisdom. And then when the Betty and Barney Hill story came out, they started comparing notes. And they said, you know what, this is happening with some of my patients, too. Am I correct in saying this?
Yes, some psychiatrists said that.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing is that a psychiatrist can recognize whether a person is delusional or whether a person is schizophrenic, whether a person is mentally ill.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Benjamin Simon realized that Betty and Barney were not mentally ill. They were not delusional. But he looked for a prosaic explanation for what happened
to
them.
Well, sure. You got to.
No, he believed in their honesty.
Right. You got to rule out all the prosaic explanations, and what's left is, if what's left is the unknown, then that's the unknown, you know? But
what I discovered when I was doing my research for the book, and I did research on that for 14 years, and I continue to do research on that before I wrote the book. What I discovered is that Betty and Barney had a very credible experience. Dr. Simon thought that perhaps Betty's series of dreams that occurred only 5 days after their experience might have been relived by Betty under hypnosis, and then even though Barney hadn't heard the content of most of her dreams, maybe he had confabulated. But I did a comparative analysis of Betty's and Barney's statements and even an analysis of their speech patterns and have come to believe that this was a real experience. And I wrote about that in great detail in Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO experience.
Right. Now, there are many misconceptions in the media regarding the case. How were you able to separate the fact from the fiction? Some of the skeptics' objections, how were you able to answer them?
Yes, well, that was the thing I think that caused me to be most interested in the case. Because back in the late 80s and early 90s, I was reading and listening and watching television programs where skeptics would give information about the case that didn't have the ring of truth to me.
Mm.
It wasn't consistent with what I recalled. So at that point, I asked Betty if she would cooperate with me. I was at that point a MUFON field investigator, and I wanted to investigate her case for myself. I wanted to do the research. And she ended up turning over 40 years of files to me. All of the investigative reports, letters to and from scientists, the Air Force Blue Book Project report, just a wealth of information. And in 1996, she gave me the hypnosis tapes with Dr. Benjamin Simon, 10 tapes, and I transcribed them. I was a lousy typist at that time, so it took a long time to do it. But I finally succeeded in transcribing all of the tapes so that I could compare Betty's and Barney's statements. I spent years and hours. I interviewed Betty, playing devil's advocate, tape recorded her statements. She and I made annual trips along her close encounter route. She and my uncle had found the landing area where they were abducted back in 1965. Mm. And so we would go there as well. I did as thorough an investigation, I believe, as anyone could possibly do. I had their psychological evaluations. I had Betty's lie detector test. I had everything that she had in her possession, and a lot of information that hadn't been released to the public. And that is what I put in Captured, the Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience. I could respond to the debunkers because I knew the facts of the case. And I had the documented evidence that the facts were true.
Do you think the debunkers, or do you know if the debunkers did any investigation on their own, or did they just, as Stanton Friedman said, make proclamations?
As far as I know, they simply made proclamations. I know that Carl Sagan listened to one hypnosis tape from the case and was highly skeptical. But for the most part, like Philip Klass, for example, did speak with Dr. Simon. But in terms of actually doing an investigation of the case, there was very little of that done because the debunkers know for a fact that it was impossible, that it couldn't have happened, and with very little information and evidence, they simply proclaim the impossibility of it.
Right. It can't be, therefore it didn't happen.
That's correct.
Stanton Friedman has alluded to, I don't know if he's ever proven it, or but he's alluded to the idea that Philip Klass was being paid work for the government, and his job was to debunk all of this stuff, disinformation campaign.
Well, Philip Klass certainly took that upon himself. I have also investigated Philip Klass. I went to the American Philosophical Society, where his archival collection is. I had an opportunity to spend a couple of days there reading through his files. I would like to do more investigation than I've actually done. I've read his books, and I know that he started his investigation of UFOs, if you want to call it that, back in 1966, when John Fuller's book, The Incident at Exeter, was released. That was the first book he ever read on UFOs, and he did it because he was his background was in electrical engineering, and he was going to go to his electrical engineering society conference that year, and there was going to be a panel on UFOs. And he loudly protested the idea that they were going to be even discussing UFOs. It was so embarrassing a subject to even discuss seriously to him. And so he read his first book to prepare to be on that panel. Well, they ended up not having the panel. But he then started to write to Edward Condon and Robert Lowe. At the end of that year, it was December of 1966, because they had begun the Colorado study, the scientific study on UFOs. And so he developed a great friendship with Robert Lowe and wrote numerous letters to him during the duration of the Colorado project. And, of course, Robert Lowe and Ed Condon, you might know about the trick letter, but Robert Lowe had written a letter to the president and people at the University of Colorado stating that in order to undertake such a project, they would have to approach it objectively, that is, they would have to admit the possibility that such things as UFOs exist, and that it wasn't respectable to give serious consideration to such a possibility. very active, admitting these possibilities just as possibilities, he said, would put them beyond the pale. So he could quite easily imagine that psychologists, sociologists, and psychiatrists might well generate scholarly publications as a result of their investigation of saucer observers. So the trick was to give the impression to the public that this was a scientific study, when those scientists conducting it would realize that they had almost no chance of finding a saucer. If that was the whole idea. It really did not take UFOs seriously, or we hadn't planned to in the beginning.
So basically what he was saying in this letter that became public was, what was it, the Condon Committee that investigated?
Condon Committee,
yeah.
Yes.
And what he said basically was the trick was to make it look like we're doing a scientific objective study when actually we'll come out with, in the end, there's nothing to it.
Yes, he said, I can give you the quote. The trick would be, I think, to describe the project so that to the public it would appear to be a totally objective study. But to the scientific community would present the image of a group of non-believers trying their best to be objective, but having almost zero expectation of finding a saucer.
So
close quote.
So what happened to Lowell because of this letter that got leaked?
Oh, well, Lowell was the project coordinator, and he kept his job.
Really?
It was those who found the memo who were fired from their positions for insubordination.
Oh, I see. Okay. So it wasn't bad to write that letter. It was bad to leak it, right?
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Oh,
the letter set up the plan and what was actually going to happen. It was those who leaked it who were punished.
Oh, I see.
And Condon attempted to discredit them.
Yeah. Kind of like airplane pilots who have UFO sightings. It's all right to have the sighting, just don't tell anybody, right?
That's true. Oh, and, you know, Condon focused on the lunatic fringe.
Yeah.
He loved to go around speaking and would always give anecdotal stories about the craziest UFO stories and what was called contactees back in the 50s, who told ludicrous stories.
Right.
And he'd draw great laughs from the audience. That's what he focused on.
Right.
And a year before the end of the project, he told one audience that he wasn't supposed to reach a conclusion for another year, but that the conclusion was that UFOs were not real.
I'm not supposed to reach a conclusion for another year, but here it
Very
is.
Very scientific,
yeah,
right?
Right. But here it is in advance, a year ahead of time.
Yes.
Preview this. Okay. So anyway, I'm going to take one more break just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, 89.3 on your radio dial, WHFR.FM on your computer. We are the station making waves. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with Kathleen Martin, author of Captured. And, you know, Kathleen, Bill Konkoleski's Michigan MUFON's state director here in Michigan.
Yes.
Have you ever met him?
Yes, I have.
Okay. He met Betty when she spoke at the MUFON symposium on the East Coast, and Betty actually gave him that blue dress she was wearing the night of the abduction for scientific analysis. And he brought it back to Michigan. I did not see
him. No, that's not what
happened. No, that's what he told me.
No, Betty never let anyone take that dress. She would give a fabric swatch from that dress.
Oh,
so that's
okay.
What he was talking about.
Oh, okay. I thought she gave him the whole dress.
Betty would never part with the entire dress. She always gave a fabric swatch.
Oh, sorry.
No, I could be misspeaking, but the Betty that I knew for all the years that I knew her would not part with that dress. Oh.
Well, I apologize to Bill Bill Konkoleski, because I miss.
I'll have to ask Bill about that.
Yeah,
I know him, and
yeah, I'm gonna have
done a book review on a book that he wrote that I thought was terrific.
Yeah, we've had him on the show. I'm going to see him in a few days. In fact, I'm going to get that straight because I thought she gave him the dress. But anyway, it was scientifically analyzed, and mm-hmm. what was the results of that analysis?
She's had it scientifically analyzed 5 different times. Now, I believe the one in Michigan was done by Dr. Levengood.
Right.
And that was a seed growth experiment.
Hmm.
And the blue portion of the dress was soaked in water, and also the pink powdery, the one that had the pink powdery substance that degraded the fabric was soaked, and then seeds were germinated and watered with the water from the dress. And I think there was also, must have been a third control sample with regular water. And what they found was that there was something in that pink powdery substance that was very energetic. Those seeds grew considerably faster than seeds would normally grow. Very significant.
They didn't say what, though. What was making them germinate?
No.
Didn't Phyllis Budinger?
My understanding, they didn't. Now, there was another one that was done, too, and if I'm thinking correctly, that dress sample was given to Bill at Rochester, New York. It was the 2001, I believe it was, UFO symposium, MUFON symposium there.
Right.
And Betty had her dress with her. I drove her out, and Phyllis Budinger was also there.
Yeah.
She's an analytical chemist
that
has done a lot of work on physical trace evidence. And she did a thorough chemical analysis on Betty's dress.
Hmm.
And she could not identify what that pink powdery substance was. No one has ever been able to identify that. She had speculated that the captor's respiratory emissions had been deposited on Betty's dress, and that was what caused pink powder to grow on the dress itself. She did find that the stained areas were coated with a biological material of mostly protein and a small amount of natural oil, and that the protein had actually attacked the fiber and the dye of the dress. But she couldn't identify what that protein was, and that it came from an external source, not from Betty.
Hmm.
So that was very perplexing.
Well, I guess. So there was that. That was physical evidence. And also, you said that Betty had a lie detector test, polygraph. Did Barney as well have a polygraph?
Unfortunately, Barney passed away. He had a massive cerebral hemorrhage in 1969.
Yeah.
And the lie detector testing was done after his death.
Okay.
So it was Betty who was tested by the head of the American Polygraph Association, or society, I can't remember what it's called.
Mm-hmm.
But she passed with flying colors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Just one test? Sometimes they do it 2 or 3.
It was on the F. Lee Bailey lie detector test show, so I'm sure that they did the normal procedure.
Right. So, according to the book Interrupted Journey, while under hypnosis, Dr. Simon tried to lead them away. You know, they're always saying that hypnotists will lead their subjects, and that's Simon's been accused of leading the subject. Both Betty and Barney Hill, but
yes, I wrote about that in Captured because as I was listening to the tapes and transcribing the tapes, I realized how Dr. Simon was trying to lead Betty and Barney away from the UFO abduction.
Right.
Anything but abduction. Don't tell me it could be that. You know, and really went very hard on them, hammering away at them to try to break their story, to try to find out where this might have come from, but he couldn't. He couldn't find anything. In the end, it was 1975, he came up with the idea of the dream hypothesis.
Mm-hmm.
Initially, he said that anything, when you got right down to it, anything was possible, that it might have happened, but that only science would be able to answer that question. And, of course, after the Condon report was released, Dr. Simon, like everyone else, was told that UFOs were not a threat, that we weren't being visited, even though if you read the center of that scientific study of unidentified flying objects, you find a lot of really very good UFO sighting cases.
Yeah. Yeah, everybody, when they refer to Project Blue Bush, Blue Book, that I like to call Project Whitewash.
Yes, good name for it.
Yeah, in the Condon Committee. At the end, they just talk about the fact that most of these sightings, most of these cases are misidentifications of conventional objects and that type of thing. And we find as investigators, you know yourself, that, yeah, that's true. Most of them are misidentifications. That doesn't mean that the 5%, 10% that can be explained aren't something else. They don't necessarily
They cannot be explained because they fall into the unknown category.
Right, right.
They weren't balloons. They weren't astronomical. They weren't aircraft. They weren't psychological. It wasn't that it was insufficient information. After a thorough analysis, they still could not be explained.
Right. So we don't say, especially in MUFON, we don't say, you know, this was, it has to be extraterrestrial, has to be other dimension. We just say it's unknown. And why can't, you know, these skeptics just admit they're unknown instead of, you know, this thing zipped across the sky and it must have been the planet Venus that zipped across the sky. You know, give us silly explanations like that.
Yes, why absolutely. And, you know, the closer something is, the better the quality of the report.
Right.
Now, you could say, well, it zipped across the sky. Who knows what it could be?
Right.
But if it's hovering less than 1,000 feet away,
mm-hmm.
if it's dish-shaped and silent, and if you see non-humans on board that craft... How do you explain that?
must have been Venus.
It must have been. One skeptic said that that Betty and Barney had actually seen the planet Jupiter. That's what it was.
We're in pretty good eyesight if they can see the people on Jupiter, right?
I know. Pretty amazing.
Really. So, in the end, what was Dr. Simon's conclusion?
Well... In 1975, when the movie, The UFO Incident, was released, he made a statement. And he said that he had a very difficult decision to make, that he believed in Betty's and Barney's honesty. He thought they were telling the truth as they perceived it.
Mm-hmm.
But that if he went forward to the public and stated that they had actually had an alien abduction, he would be telling everyone what they all wanted to hear, but that had not been scientifically proven.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, he couldn't make that statement because it had not been scientifically proven.
Mm-hmm. But what had been proven, as far as Simon was concerned, was that Betty and Barney were not lying. They were not hallucinating.
Correct.
They were telling the truth under hypnosis, and the conscious memories beginning of the, before the abduction, the onset of the abduction, and the aftermath of the abduction were conscious memories.
That's correct.
But it's just Simon that filled in the blanks, right?
That is correct.
Yeah, so.
Very, it was a pretty amazing story.
Yeah.
And if you go to John Fuller's archival collection at Boston University, you can read the letters that Dr. Simon wrote John. And in that archival collection is the letter that he received from one of his colleagues. And his colleague was chiding him, saying that, you know, now after your very outstanding career as a psychiatrist, you're going to go down in history as the hypnotist who hypnotized Betty and Barney Hill, the UFO abductees. And, you know, it was really a criticism of Dr. Simon. And, you know, I think that that kind of thing had an impact upon his opinion of what happened, because he did have a very outstanding reputation. He was in Who's Who in America, and he really didn't want to be associated with UFOs.
Right. Especially back then. But, you know, back then, it was a criticism, and they were looking down upon him for this because of the mindset of the public. But as time goes by, even today, I think, and certainly in the future, he will be the visionary that that interview, or rather, that hypnotized Betty and Barney Hill. You know that?
I believe so.
Yeah.
He was a very brave man, right. I think, to permit his name to be used in the interrupted journey and actually to write the foreword to that book.
Right. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, not to get off of that subject, but we are running a little short of time, and I wanted to get in that you and Denise Stoner of Florida's MUFON, Florida's MUFON's chief investigator, have three questionnaires on your website, and tell us about those and your research projects.
Yes, Denise and I are both abduction researchers. She's Florida's chief investigator, and I'm now MUFON's director of abduction studies. We decided that we wanted to be able to identify commonalities among abductees. So we have three questionnaires that are on my website at www.kathleen-marden.com. And the first questionnaire is a general 45-question questionnaire for people who believe that they have been abducted. The second one has 16 questions, and it is for individuals, abductees, who actually recall the interior of the craft, the kind of procedures that they went through. And then there is a third one for people who deny having been abducted. We wanted to find out if some of these commonalities were common across the general population or were common specifically to abductees. So I would encourage anyone to go onto my website and take these questionnaires. You can just email the results back to me, and we would greatly appreciate it.
That's Kathleen hyphen Marden, MARDEN.com, right?
Yes, and it's completely confidential. The questionnaires during the study will be kept in a locked file, and they will be destroyed when the study is completed.
And don't you think that people who do not feel they have been abducted or do not believe in the UFO phenomenon at all, they won't even go to the website, do you think? They won't take the questionnaire?
No, I've had 18 people who have gone to the website and completed the questionnaire for non-abductees.
Mm-hmm. How did they compare?
There are people who haven't seen UFOs or haven't been abducted who listen to these shows as well.
Yeah. How do those compare with those who claim to have abduction experiences?
For the most part, they're different. I have had three people who reported that they have had paranormal activity in their home, but the percentage is much higher among people who have actually experienced alien abduction. Mm.
I wonder how much of that, of course, this is getting off into another show, but I wonder how much of the paranormal poltergeist activity is alien-related, and I wonder how much alien activity or UFO activity is really paranormal or other dimensional, you know?
Well, I have a theory about that, too. I think that, and I do think that the alien activity is alien activity.
Okay.
But I suspect that when they go into people's homes, they have a process where they can actually pass through windows or walls. And I think in that process, it is almost like an interdimensional kind of thing.
Right.
And that there are non-living people, people who have passed on, probably in that sort of vortex or gateway,
right,
and that they can slip in and cause this type of activity.
So,
I've also received reports from abductees who state that they've had light orbs in their homes, and some have actually seen these light orbs pop into or expand into ETs.
Mm. So it's all related. It's all connected somehow.
It seems to be connected at least during the abduction process.
Right. You know, I wanted to get into your other book on where science was wrong, but maybe we can do another show next month. What do you think?
Sounds good to me.
Okay. I'd like to get into that as well.
And okay.
Meanwhile, the book Captured, where can we find that?
You can go to my website, Kathleen Marden, Kathleen-Marden.com. You can get an autographed copy there of any of my three books. There's another one, UFOs and Aliens. It's an anthology, and I have a chapter in that as well.
Okay.
So you can go there and autograph by both Stanton Friedman and myself.
Okay.
Or you can get it at Amazon or at Barnes & Noble. It's at that bookstore as well.
Very good. Kathleen Marden, thank you so much for joining us today, and we'll get back with you and talk about your other book the next time.
Oh, it was my pleasure, and I didn't mean to badmouth Bill. I have a great deal of respect for him.
Right.
It's just I think that it was the dress sample and not the dress itself.
Very good. Very good. Thanks again. And if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. This show, as well as all of the forum shows, is now archived at whfr.fm's website. Click on the talk shows and on the homepage, and then Tuesday Forum. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, ufoimplications.com. So please stay tuned to WHFR.FM, the station making waves for the best in alternative programming. I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m.